This is Radio Stockdale.
Welcome to an encore presentation of Radio Stockdale. Our guest was the keynote speaker at the 2022 McCain Conference at the Naval Academy. His comments on artificial intelligence and the Department of Defense are still on point. Lieutenant General Michael Groen is the director, Joint Artificial Intelligence Center, the JAIC. He leads the JAIC team in transforming U.S. joint warfare and departmental processes through the integration of artificial intelligence. The JAIC was set up because we're at an inflection point in warfare, moving from muscle power to machine power to compute power. I hear the JAIC talking about data, predictive analytics, and artificial intelligence. How do you work with service components to get that job done?
Yeah, so the services, of course, are key in anything that happens in the Department of Defense. The services are the mechanisms through which resources flow into the department or into the services, where they build service capabilities, right? Organize, train, and equip is the function of the services. So from an OSD perspective, we have access to policymakers. We have access to, the research and engineering arm of the department. We have access to help guide resources and policy. But clearly that's not enough, right? Like if we're really going to make a difference in the implementation in our warfare communities, well, then the services are the place to do that. And so we've done a lot of work with the services to try to, as each service has started to go down this journey, and within some services, like multiple communities have independently gone down this journey. So the adoption of AI has exploded across the department. But it's done in very narrow pockets, and not in every case is it done in a way that's lasting and actually materially contributes to warfighting capability. There's a difference between technology and capability, of course. And the services are the ones that take the technology and turn it into capability within that service. But in this transformational environment, like in the information warfare environment, each of us having our own network, our own stovepipe processes with our own infrastructure, our own data, our own algorithms and our own outputs isn't going to meet the requirement for a joint force that can fight effectively across all domains with a common information environment, a common sensing of the battle space, a common sensing of their own abilities and their own abilities, and the enemy's abilities. Like that doesn't happen service by service. That has to come together as a joint force and as a department level enterprise. And so like our mandate, working with the services is really important. They're our most important partners. They have the money, but we have to help them see a path to work together. And that's, so the joint force becomes really important here too. But when you think about this environment that we're moving into, this is much more intrusive than even jointness as we play it today, right? Jointness today, I think of as like billiard balls, in a rack, and they're very close to each other and they're in tight formation and the rack holds them that way. But the billiard balls, preserve their integrity, right? Like they have their own processes inside that billiard ball and nobody else can touch that. Think about an environment where we have broad situational awareness that everybody shares. We have shared appreciation for where the enemy is, what the enemy's intent is, what patterns show that the enemy is likely to do, what things are happening in the battle space today, and the same visibility of our own capabilities, right? So like when a threat is detected, a very compelling target pops up on the screen, that compelling target's going to be available and observable by across the joint force, right? And so like how do we make decisions now about how to prosecute that target, If it's an enemy ship, for example, do you bring an aviation capability against that target? Do you do, a land-based anti-ship missile? Do you do long-range rocket artillery? Do you, bring another ship or a submarine or like all of these, all of these ways to prosecute a target in tomorrow's joint force where we're integrated, from a data environment? We're going to have to build like new processes because we're going to be able to do this so fast. It's going to be a matter of like, how do we create the processes so we make good decisions quickly and make smart decisions about you know, preserving some capabilities so that we can, you know, that we can be ready to fight tomorrow at the same, you know, at the same time we're prosecuting the targets today. So services are core to all of that warfighting development.
What do you see as the ethical implications of AI in the Department of Defense?
To me, like one of the most important questions, there's an expectation, right? And we all carry this. Anybody who wears a uniform or has worn a uniform knows, you know, is very familiar with things like the law of armed conflict, right? And the legal imperatives and the moral imperatives of warfighting. And so like integration of artificial intelligence, you know, anytime in any environment where, you know, human lives are at risk or, you know, could be impacted by AI, you know, think self-driving cars, you know, think, you know, automated things on work sites, et cetera. It's really important in those kind of environments to think about ethics. In a defense environment, holy cow, there's nothing more important than having an ethical foundation for everything that we do. And that absolutely includes our technology and the way we fight. And it absolutely includes artificial intelligence. And so like in first order, right? I think I get asked a lot, you know, hey, why do we let this ethics stuff slow us down? You know, our opponents don't have these ethics, and so they can move really fast. And I will tell you that's completely backwards, right? In my mind, the way I formulate it, you know, as a Marine, when you're stepping out on a patrol, you're always thinking about, hey, being careful is smooth, and having a process is smooth, and smooth is fast, right? So you don't hurry. You move at a pace that allows you to be smooth so that you make good decisions. You don't tire yourself out. You're aware of your surroundings. You're not just running headlong into the problem. An ethical baseline for your artificial intelligence makes it smooth, right? Because we know that we're consistent with the laws of armed conflict. We know that we're consistent with the ethic that we carry as a member of the American military, right? So like this makes things smooth when you can think this way. And then smooth becomes fast, right? Because now once you know that you're operating from an ethical baseline and you know how to make that baseline, you know, turn that baseline into material action, now you're fast. So let me talk to you about like how do you take that ethical baseline and actually, you know, turn it into implementation guidance. And this is the work. I mean, it starts with the, you know, the AI ethical principles that the department established, two or three years ago now, reliable, traceable, equitable, responsible, governable, right? So like these, like ethical principles begin the thinking process of like how are we building our AI, and are we cognizant of all of those sort of, you know, failure modes of reliability, for example, or equitability or responsibility, governability. Like all of those things have implications for how you actually build your AI. So as you start to think through those principles and use those principles as a baseline for your development, then you have to start thinking about, okay, well, how do I actually begin to trust my artificial intelligence that's built through this, you know, this ethical pathway? And so you have to have things like test and evaluation, right? And rigorous testing, you know, inside the lab on the algorithms themselves, testing in the operational environment in which that algorithm is going to operate, and understanding the failure modes when things happen, the sensitivities to different types of data. So all of these things are tested inside our environment. And so that test and evaluation is a critical component. But it doesn't stop there either, because it works in the lab somewhere, you really have to put it through its paces in the environment that's going to be operating in. And so things like, we call it validation and verification, right? Like validation that the algorithm is actually working in the conditions it's under, and then verification that it actually works in the environment that it's operating in, and then validation that it operates effectively in the human machine system that is created by AI, right? So rarely do we have an AI operating by itself. It's generally either feeding information to a human or enabling a human to do something, maybe even driving the human around in the battlefield. But like that, you know, getting that human systems integration piece so that not just testing our algorithms, but testing them in an ecosystem that they're going to have to operate with the humans that have to operate it, in that full battlefield context. When you work your way all through that, we call that the journey to trust, because at the end of that process, you have service members who trust their AI because they know the boundaries, they know what it does, they know how it works, and where it might not work, or where its effectiveness might be degraded. And so having smart humans, like, you know, in that process makes you fast, right? Because it's smooth, because we've done this process or this journey to trust. Now we can move quickly because people understand the environment that they're in. There's one final piece to this though. Trust is a wonderful thing, but trust is not good enough, right? So you can trust things that maybe you haven't really explored it. And so you're just taking it on faith that something's going to work effectively the way you think it's going to work. And so it's much more than just trust. It really comes down to assurance. So not only are users confident in the systems, but we've tested it to the degree we've established that, you know, with evidence and arguments, the whole test, you know, operational test environments, that yes, this capability is good and it is, is something that we are prepared to bring to the battlefield. That sounds complex, but when you walk the journey of all the way to AI assurance, then you know you have good tech. You know that it works effectively. You know that it's consistent with the moral imperatives and the legal imperatives of the battlefield. Then you can move really fast.
And finally, what can a junior officer do today? What can that JO do to make sure he or she is ready to use AI assets, especially when they need to be on or in the loop?
Those junior officers that are preparing to come into the force, you know, clearly there's going to be a focus on technical education and technical familiarity. And that's critical for everybody. It doesn't matter what occupational field you're going to be in. Every occupational field is already being impacted by AI technology. And so when you show up in your occupational field, whether you're in manpower or submarines in an airplane, you know, doing weather, you know, you're a Marine, you know, moving into a patrol, you're going to be using AI. And so you need to understand, you don't need to be a coder necessarily, but you need to understand the technology and the core elements of like why data-driven decision making and machines that help you understand the data that you're presented with are so valuable in the battlefield. And when you understand that, when you learn how to think about how to employ this technology, then you can really start to think about how you can gain tempo, how you can take processes that are not automated, but probably should be, and identify those processes to say, hey, you know what? I don't want to have to get an email before I can launch on this patrol with this information. I want to have that on my goggles, all the time. Like that kind of thinking about, hey, I want technology applied to my warfighting function all the way down to the tactical edge and then all the way back up, right? So like really understanding the technology, understand how to think about your problems in an information age, that applies no matter what your warfighting function is. But then when you get out to the fleet and you start employing, you know, your leadership capabilities in a real operational environment, then you suddenly become, you know, not just a learner but a teacher, right? And even the juniorest of officers has a responsibility, right, to teach and to train and to mentor and to understand, to make sure that their soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, guardians are all like trained to mission and understand that they understand not only the enemy environment, but they understand their own technical environment too and how they bring solutions together. So that's really important. When you get in, you know, as you start to move up the ladder inside the services, so, you know, junior officers need to have an eye to, hey, look, you know, those generations that came before me may not have had the same appreciation of technology that I do. And so, you know, maybe they are our things that, you know, that they've designed a process that, it was really good 15 years ago, but it's obsolete today. And so like having your eyes open for opportunities to help the transformation here. And I think that's really, that's really important for actually, you know, building technical talent and aligning it with your functional talent that grows with you, right? As you gain more experience in the service, you'll become a really good submariner or aviator or intelligence person or, you know, a resource person. Like all of those things, as your functional expertise grows, your ability to bring technology into that place really becomes, it's on you, right? Like you have the opportunity to identify where the gaps are. And I think, you know, anybody, you know, moving forward or entering the services now, you're entering a transformed environment or an environment that is in transformation, right? And so, you know, as you have your tech talent, your functional talent, I think you should also have an appreciation for where you are in history. And I think as we started talking about the Lancers, you know, early in this conversation, young officers are leading or entering the service in a period of transformation. And it's a historic period, right? I mean, you could liken it to the introduction of gunpowder, right? Or liken it to the introduction of, mobile armored activity, right? At the eve of World War II. And if you're leading at this transformational moment of history, then by definition, as a leader, you are going to make history during your career. You will drive this transformation. The service you leave, however many years from now, will be different than the service you joined. What things enthrall us today? Is it a commitment to, you know, a certain type of vessel or a certain type of aircraft or a certain technology that we just feel is core to our being, yet might not stand the scrutiny of operations and the tempo of a modernized environment? You have to help the department disenthrall themselves with things that they're comfortable with so that they can think of the capabilities and the technology that they need to actually succeed on tomorrow's battlefield. And I hope you seize the gauntlet, right? Because this is critical for not just our military competitiveness, but our national competitiveness and all that implies for our ethic as a nation and for what we are and who we are as the United States. And so I wish you all the best in that. And I hope you are always thinking about how you're shaping the world for tomorrow.
You've been listening to Radio Stockdale, a series of podcasts produced by the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership at the United States Naval Academy. You can hear more podcasts at stockdalecenter.com/podcasts.